Well, please turn back with me to Mark's Gospel and Mark chapter 8, and we'll be looking at those verses we read a moment ago. I'm sure you've had turning points in your life that you can remember that were very significant. I mean, turning points aren't they? That's the whole idea of them. Here it is. It's you something, a single point. It can be for many quite insignificant, but for you very, very big, and it's changed your whole life. For myself, just to give a small example of this, a turning point in my school life was the year that I discovered I quite liked being on stage in front of people. You will realize that preaching and being on stage is altogether a different thing, and I don't certainly always look forward to preaching, but I always did the stage and always enjoyed it. You know, my school record of attendance was particularly poor all the way up until I was about 15, and then I discovered I am an introverted extrovert, if I can use that phrase. I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but for me, here I was, quite quiet, quite to myself, very happy in my own company, but give me a play or a stage and an audience, and I'm quite happy to be an extrovert all of a sudden. But you know, ever since there it was, the teacher trying to teach me to write, I was learning how to feign sickness and how to stay out of school. But there, that learning about drama and being able to study what I wanted to study, that was a turning point for me at school, certainly giving me a better attendance record, to say the least. It was a turning point, certainly not as big as the turning point that happened when I was 14, but I can tell you about that another day. But here in Mark 8, we come to a turning point for his disciples, for the disciples of Jesus Christ. Mark has been asking the question through the characters we read of, the real life, historic characters who met Jesus, some his friends, some his opponents. They've always been asking the question, Mark's been laying it out, who is he? Who is Jesus? And now, in Mark chapter 8, we have not just the opinions of others, but we have the opinion of the disciples. They give us their answer. They give us their conclusion. And it's got huge consequences for everybody else. And so we're going to just take a look at this, a brief look. It's certainly going to be that, but three things to say: the revelation of the king, the prophecy of the king, and thirdly, the demands of the king. So let's first look at the revelation of the king, verses 27 to 30. Jesus has a question for the disciples, and it's one of the most direct questions in the whole gospel. Here it is, verse 29. He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Who do you say that I am? In fact, up in Liverpool, it's not in the New King James, but it's in the AV, there's a church there who have that. They're just situated outside a bus stop in between Everton Football Club and Liverpool Football Club, so they're in a great position for outreach, you might think, I don't know. But there they are, and the sign above their door is, "Who do you say I am?" And it's in a different version, but it's there. And it's a great question, but it's a question Jesus directly aims at his disciples. He knew the conclusions of others, but what mattered was what his disciples thought. And Peter's answer is the turning point of the whole of Mark's gospel. His answer is the answer Mark wants you and I to have, and that he's been building up to from chapter 1. Here it is, you know it already because we've read it. Verse 29, Peter answered and said to him, "You are the Christ." Now, I want to stop here and pause for a minute and ask this question. How is it that Peter has come to this conclusion? How is it that he's come to this conclusion? Because I want us to know that it is clear that this wasn't just his opinion, Like, you know, his opinion about Jesus, and it just goes in the think tank of all these other opinions that have been going around. That all the opinions are as equal and as valid as any other others. It's not in that category. Something else has made it much more than just an opinion. In Matthew's gospel, and Matthew was there, an eyewitness, and I believe Mark, he was influenced heavily by Peter himself. But Matthew, he adds an extra bit of narrative for us. And it's in Matthew 16, verses 16 to 17. And this is what Matthew adds. He says, Simon Peter answered and said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus answered and said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." God had revealed this to him. And I think Mark wants us to know that too, because Mark is very good in his gospel, if you know his structure, of wedging a certain truth in between two other things that he, to make his point, two other incidents. Mark kind of does that, and he'll sandwich it together so that we know what the point is he's getting at. And what has gone on before this confession from Peter is a miracle. And let's read verses 22 to 26 together. Then he came to Bethsaida, and they brought a blind man to him and begged him to touch him. So he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the town. And when he had spit on his eyes and put his hands on him, he asked him if he saw anything. And he looked up and said, "I see men like trees walking." Then he put his hands on his eyes again and made him look up. And he was restored and saw everyone clearly. Do you know, here's this, the what's been going on for this blind man, the step-by-step sight receiving of this man, has been what has spiritually been going on for Peter and the other disciples. Here he is, they've been watching him, they've been observing him closely, and they've seen him do miracles that no one else could possibly do. To say to a man lowered down through a roof that your sins are forgiven, and then to, as people thought this man's blaspheming, he says, "Well, which one's harder to say, your sins are forgiven, or that take up your bed and walk?" And the answer is neither. Neither are easier to say. Both are impossible. And yet Jesus says, "Just so you know, I can do the one. Here, I'll do the other. Take up your bed and walk." And so he gets up and he's well again. And everyone's amazed. They're stunned. And they ask, "Who is this man?" And then Jesus goes with the disciples out to sea. And there he is in the boat asleep, and this storm comes up, making these rough, tough fishermen very afraid for their lives, and they wake him up, and with a word he makes this storm calm instantly. I've been at sea in a storm, and that doesn't happen. It takes a while for the waves to go down, but it was still. They saw it. They were amazed. Who could this man be? Even the wind and the wave obey him. And then he sits down 5,000 men one day in a desolate place and shows that he is the shepherd that they've been waiting for. As he feeds, he sits them down on the green grass and feeds them from just 5 loaves and 2 fish. And again, the disciples, they're asking, "Who is this man?" And now here, bit by bit, they've been seeing, and now Peter says, "You are the Christ. You are God's King, God's anointed one." The more time he spent with Jesus, gradually he began to see more than just a Galilean peasant. But the eyes of his understanding were opened by God to see clearly that Jesus was King. Now, can I ask you, are you like Peter? You like Peter? Here he is. He's rightly discovered Jesus is God's King. And I wonder this evening, I know I'm speaking to few, but have you come and made that same discovery? It didn't come quickly to Peter. It was a step-by-step discovery. He watched the actions of Jesus. He listened to the teachings of Jesus closely and was always asking, who is this man? And I'd suggest if you haven't been like Peter, if you haven't discovered who Jesus is, then you need to do the same as Peter. If Peter was right, then Jesus is king and has demands on your life you need to obey. But if he wasn't right, then you can carry on as you are, can't you? It doesn't matter. But have you given Jesus an honest investigation? Because Peter did search. God revealed it to him. God opened his eyes to who Jesus was. And I say this often to people in the open air, and I'm not afraid to say it to them, that if they honestly take a gospel and read it for themselves and investigate the life of Jesus Christ, God, I'm sure, is happy to give the faith to believe. He's happy to open the spiritual eyes of our understanding to know that Jesus Christ is who the Bible claims him to be. Are you like Peter? Well, there's the revelation of the king. It's been revealed to Peter. But here's, secondly, the prophecy of the king in verses 31 to 33. Doesn't it all seem good? Here it is. Here's Peter. He's learned that Jesus is the Christ of God that the Jewish nation's been hoping for and they've been waiting for since the beginning of the world. And yet, let me just find this. I may have a page missing. That's really helpful to do, isn't it? Let me carry on. Because here, let me just find that. It all seems good to him. But what does he find instead? Here's Peter. He's going to tell the world about this Jesus. And what do we find, Peter? What do we find? What's the next thing off Jesus' lips? He tells them not to tell anyone. And then he goes away and he starts to tell them that he's going to die. Here he is, Jesus, the king that they've been waiting for. When he gets to Jerusalem, they are going to, those who Peter thinks will receive him and welcome him with celebration and with thanksgiving, that the tyranny of the Romans is going to come crashing down. Jesus says, when I arrive there, your elders, your teachers, those who should know the promises of this book, are going to take me and they're going to kill me. And then I'm going to rise again on the third day. Peter doesn't hear that bit though, does he? He hears you're going to be killed. So what's his reaction? You know, this is crushing for Peter. This is absolutely crushing for him. And what does he do? He turns to Jesus and he takes him aside, verse 32, and he began to rebuke him. It's almost like this. Here is Peter and he says, you are the king. But then he listens to the words of Jesus and says, but no, you cannot do this. You're the king and you can do as you want, but you can't do that. And what is it that Jesus says to him in reply? Look at verse 33 with me. He turned around and looked at his disciples. He rebuked Peter, saying, get behind me, Satan. Now, it's not going well for you if Jesus calls you Satan. I just want to make that very clear if we're not understanding that. If Jesus, the Son of God, says, get behind me, Satan, and he's looking at you, that's not a good position to be in. That's a rebuke. That's not a pat on the back. Well done for just having another opinion. Well done for kind of just trying to persuade me. You know, it's glass half full for Peter. You know, well done for being pessimistic. This is no, get behind me, Satan. And it seems harsh, doesn't it? Here is Jesus calling Peter Satan. What's he saying? Well, if on the one hand, Peter has come to understand that Jesus is the king because it's been revealed to him by God, then for, for Peter to take the teachings of Jesus about the cross and his sufferings for the sins of many and to deny that and to turn to Jesus and rebuke that, to reject that teaching, well, that's not the mind of God. That's not what God's revealed to him. That's the influence of God's enemy, the devil. So here on the one hand, God has revealed Jesus is king to Peter. And on the other hand, Peter looks at the cross and he looks at its shame. And he looks at the inglory. Nothing pretty about the cross, was there? And Peter says, I'll have none of that. That is to be influenced by God's enemy, the devil. Because he was thinking not about the things of God, but he had his mind on things below. He had his mind on Jesus, King of all, Jesus with all the pomp and majesty that comes with royalty. He had his mind on a great nation being even greater. He had his mind on conquering the world, I'm guessing. He didn't have his mind on the things and the plan of God that Jesus Christ should come, suffer and die before receiving glory for his people. And isn't it easy for us today to be a bit like Peter in this too? Friends, if I wanted you to be like Peter in the last point, then in this point, can I ask you again, are you like Peter? But this time I'm not putting it positively, I'm putting it negatively. Are you like Peter here? That and we don't need to be unbelievers to be like Peter in this point. For many today, they will have Jesus and declare him as king. But that even popular Bible teachers in recent years have turned away from the cross. That God should send his son and rescue sinners by allowing him to suffer and die in their place on a barbaric Roman crucifix? Oh, we'll have none of that. We'll call it a good example of Jesus laying down his life, but we won't have, as one famous Bible teacher who shouldn't be listened to anymore, quite frankly, says, it's like cosmic child abuse. Dear friends, it's a very real danger in our church, in our Christian lives, to become ashamed of the cross. And we must be very careful of going to that place. If we feel a little bit of shame in the cross as we speak to our friends at work or at leisure, and, you know, they have conferences, you know. They have conferences that take the mick out of the cross. You only need to look on YouTube to find them. The humanistic societies, the atheistic societies, they have conferences and they mock the cross. And it's very easy in our day and age. As people look on and go, 2,000 years ago, you believe a Nazarene carpenter died on a cross for your sin? To procure heaven for you? Very easy, friends, to become ashamed. But we must remember the words of Paul. Now, he's an intelligent man, wasn't he? You've got to admit that about Paul. And if the cross is foolish, well, it must have insulted his intelligence. But this is what he says in 1 Corinthians 1, verse 18. For the word of the cross is folly to those who are university graduates? No. The word of the cross is folly to those who are Oxford professors? No. For the word of the cross is folly to those who are modern? No. The word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing. But to us who are being saved, it is the power of God, isn't it? Peter was not thinking the way God wanted him to think. And when we are the least bit ashamed of the cross, we must bring to mind, we must remember that we're not thinking like God. We're being influenced by Satan himself. So don't be like Peter. But thirdly, let's look at the demands of the king. And hopefully I've got all my pages for this one. The demands of the king, verse 34 to 38. See, the disciples and perhaps others witnessed Jesus tell Peter off for having the wrong mindset. But then Jesus calls the crowd. You know, Jesus, he's got a wonderful way of using a rebuke to teach others and using a negative and turning it into a positive. Because here he brings the crowd and the disciples over to hear the kind of mindset that he demands of those who would follow him as their king. And this is hard for us to swallow sometimes, but let's go through it step by step. You see, it's summarized in verse 34 and it's expanded in verses 35 to 38. So here's the summary version. If you can't remember or stay with me for the rest of it, remember this. Verse 34, if anyone would come after me, or whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. So the following verses unpack this for us and explain to us what our mindset is to be. And very simply, to follow Jesus as king is to have the mindset of self-denial. To die to myself. So let's look at why Jesus makes such a radical demand. Verse 35. Jesus, he teaches that a follower of him gives every part of their life in surrender to him. They lose their life. They lose their life. The day you became a Christian, you lost your life. But some hear the gospel, they want to follow Jesus, but don't want to give Jesus authority over every part. They want to save their life. Now the problem is that in the long term, and I know it's the long term, eternity is focused on here, because even though it says that verse 35, it's talking about life, that's interchangeable with the word soul. It's, in fact, life and soul in this context are the same word in the original. And also verse 38, whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, as you are living now, 70, 80 years maybe, in between his ascension to heaven and his return, if you're ashamed of him in your life now, well, there's an eternity to come, and of him the Son of Man also will be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. And so he says, we can look at verse 35 and see that the problem is that in the long term, the person without Jesus who wants to save their life and doesn't want to surrender every part over to Jesus Christ ultimately loses their life. You see, your soul's eternal. Your life lasts forever. It's not you only live once. Well, it is in a way. You only live once. But that once is a very, very long time. And it's a much longer time than those people who've came up with you only live once ever thought of. And then verse 36, Jesus says that you can live without him. You can live without him and have a happy life. Do you know, I received an email the other week, of a young man who I'm good friends with. And he told me this reason for not coming on Beach Mission this year was because he is now no longer a Christian. He's not following the Lord Jesus Christ. And he wanted me to know that he's living a happy life and he's in a much better position now. He feels happier about himself now. And I'm sure he can. I'm sure you can be a happy person and live a happy life without Jesus Christ. Probably, sometimes, much more than a Christian can. But look, Jesus says you can live without him. You can gain the whole world. But in the end, has it profited you anything? In the end, it hasn't. Not a single thing. Because life without Jesus is eternity without Jesus. And in verse 37, Jesus says, in view of this, what can we give in return for our souls? What can we give in return for our life? What exchange can we make that will truly benefit us? Well, the answer is meant to be nothing. And so the logical conclusion of those few verses is to surrender our lives wholly to King Jesus and not to leave a tiny bit of it back, not to hold any of it back. But maybe you're asking this question, why does life without Jesus mean I lose my life eternally? Well, to that person, I've got to say very honestly, whether you surrender to him or not, Jesus is still king. There are some things that we just can't change, aren't there? And I'm just being very honest here. Jesus is the king. And if you haven't surrendered, you are in rebellion and you are in great danger. I want you to forgive me for this this illustration, because I'm sure someone might not like it. But the only place I can really find to illustrate this was in the Harry Potter films. And, you know, whatever you think of that, at least give me a little bit of a moment to share what happens in the final one, where Harry, he's got his antagonist villain Voldemort, who's kind of been very murderous, and there's a prophecy one day that Harry finds, and it says this: neither can live while the other survives. And I won't go into all the details of that, but basically, if you've never read them and you plan to, then I'm sorry, I'm going to spoil the ending. If you've never read them, then, and you have never, no intention of going to that sort of thing, then that's fine anyway. You now know the end. Because Harry, he walks into this, he knows the only way for his friends to stop dying and being killed in this great battle against this evil wizard is to go and surrender his life. And he goes in, and the big scene's there, and it's all dark, and it's all very dramatic, because it's the only place where the film doesn't decide to have that music going, and he gets killed. He dies on the spot. The other has killed, Harry has died, he's walked into it. However, unknowingly, this is exactly what Harry needed to do to win. And so Harry, he returns to life again. You can see, you know, some areas of this. He comes back to life again, and it's as he lives, he can now have the power to destroy this evil villain Voldemort once and for all. And the point is the paradox. If Harry wanted to live, he needed to die first. And you might not like the illustration, and you may burn me at the stake for it, but the point is clear. For the Christian, if we really want fullness of life in Jesus Christ, if we really want Jesus Christ to be everything, if we really want to have the sort of experiences that the Tozers speak of and that the Spurgeons speak of, that intimate relationship with our Lord Jesus Christ, then, dear friends, we need to start by dying. We need to start by dying to ourselves, by giving everything over to him. That means our future ambitions, our sexual relationships and desires, our friendships, our family. Do you know, Jesus says, anyone who loves his father or mother or brothers or sisters before me is not worthy of me. Dear friends, we need to love our family, of course. But where is Jesus Christ? Have we given everything over to him? Is there what the Puritans called the bosom sin that still has a grip on us? And it's got a grip on us, not because Christ hasn't cancelled its power, not because Christ isn't offering us the grace and the strength and the exit that we need when the temptation comes, but it's still our bosom sin because it's close to our heart. Can I ask you the question about that sort of sin that stays close to you? Can I ask you this? As you look to heaven, where you will be free from sin, Are you longing for the day where that sin is gone? Now, of course, we're being sanctified and we're not perfect yet and we're not free from the power of sin yet. But are we desiring that that sin, that all the pleasure it might give us, or even just not sins, maybe good things that give us pleasure and we value them more than we value Jesus Christ, are we willing to put them to death so that we might have life in Jesus more abundantly, more fully, the sort of life that he intends for us to have? So Christian friend, are you trying, maybe here this evening, you're trying to save your life, but really you're in danger of losing it eternally. Now, I believe in the perseverance of the saints, but the warning is here very clearly. If you're trying to save your life, even as a professing Christian, you're in danger of losing it eternally. Maybe you've recognized that Jesus is the Christ, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, but you still want things your way. Maybe you still want to do what your friends at work are doing. You know, peer pressure doesn't go away, does it, when you leave school? Continues on. And when Jesus teaches something, maybe here on a Sunday, something that maybe you disagree with, maybe your neighbours or family or friends disagree with, you silently in your heart take him to the side and give him a telling off. Please don't teach that again. Please don't make that demand on me again. Maybe you wouldn't say it as brashly as that. You want him to be silent and not to embarrass you. But the only way to truly save your life is to surrender the whole of it. There's a blind man at Dunstable who some of you know. And whenever I speak to him, he always quotes this hymn to me. Trust and obey, for there's no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey. Do you know the Christian cannot, I'm convinced, be truly happy without giving themselves completely over to the Lord Jesus Christ? But maybe you're not a believer here this evening, and do you know your life is the most precious thing, isn't it? But it's the most precious thing because it's an eternal thing. Maybe you're living only for this life, and well, take the warning that by only living for this life, God gives you what you want. And actually, you're losing your life. There is a judgment to come, and we will all stand before Jesus Christ, and you'll stand before him whom you've never trusted, whom you've never given any worth to, whom you've never loved, whom you've never believed, whom you were ashamed of. Can I ask you a question? How will you stand? How will you stand? If you want to keep your life, lose it. Lose it to Jesus Christ, because then you will find it truly. Let me finish by reading a part of Psalm 2. God speaks, yet I have set my king on my holy hill of Zion. I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me and I will give you the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. Now therefore be wise, O kings, be instructed, you judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way when his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are all those who put their trust in him.